may or may not have heard about this, but last week in Ohio, there was something of a riot when a large group of passionate young people gathered on the streets of Columbus in a great display of solidarity. The gathering started out peacefully, but before the night was over, folks in the mostly nonviolent crowd started lighting fires, destroying private property, getting in fights. The police came in with what some people have called an excessive display of force. There were batons and pepper spray employed to keep the crowd in line and to send people home. As I read news accounts about what transpired in Columbus, it sounded a lot like what was happening in Oakland and in Berkeley last fall. There were some significant differences, however. First, whereas the protests here in the East Bay came in response to the deaths of Mike Brown and Eric Garner and other unarmed African-American men and boys, and perhaps more than that, the folk who took to our streets were protesting the impunity the American justice system has granted to white police officers directly responsible for those deaths. In Oakland and Berkeley, folks were marching because they wanted the world to know that black lives matter. In Columbus, they were rioting in the streets because the Ohio State University football team had just won the national championships. It
seems that I can make fun of football here because all the football fans are at home making seven-layer dip in preparation for games this afternoon.
Was that not all of them?
That's why God invented TiVo, right?
Here's another difference. The protests in the East Bay arose out of the African-American community. The rioters in Ohio were predominantly white. And as a result, no one paid much attention to the folks in Ohio. As you know, after the sometimes violent and destructive marches in Oakland and Berkeley, the national media had a big discussion about race. And it wasn't necessarily the kind of discussion that might have been productive. Now, it's true. Some media outlets were indeed talking about important things. Some media outlets were talking about issues such as poverty and unequal access to education and mass incarceration and white privilege and societal marginalization. But as often as not, the white-dominated media were asking what was wrong with black people. They were asking, why couldn't they behave nonviolently? Why couldn't they just take advantage of all the opportunities available to every American? Why are so many black children being raised without their families? And what's the deal with those baggy pants? But when a crowd of mostly white college students in Ohio went berserk, not because anyone had done them wrong, but because their team had won, defeating an opponent whose mascot was the Ducks, for crying out loud, there was, to my knowledge, no soul searching. If a major American media outlet brought in a leader from the white community to talk about why white youth are violent, or to cluck their tongues over their deficiencies in white parenting, or to shame the fashion choices of white adolescent males, I don't know about it. Nor do I know about any major news outlet talking about substantive issues raised by the riot in Ohio. It might have been a good idea or a good opportunity to talk about violence in football. It might have been a good opportunity to talk about how in most of the 50 states, the highest paid government employee is the football coach at a public university. And where it's not the football coach, it's the basketball coach. There was ample opportunity for substantive discussion. But as far as I know, all there was silence. And it's not like this is an isolated event. I did a Google search, and I found that such hooliganism is actually not that uncommon when college football teams win national championships. It's something that's done. The team wins, and white kids go out and burn things. Now, I suppose many Americans, and probably most of us here, would agree
that the media should have spent a little more time talking about what happened in Columbus when the Buckeyes won the national championship. Indeed, most Americans, or at least those whose worldview is not formed by Fox News, most Americans would agree that we're missing an opportunity to have a much-needed conversation in the media sphere. But here's a more difficult question. Is this a conversation that we should be having in church? Naturally, I think so, or else I wouldn't be bringing it up. But I suspect most Americans would think it inappropriate for a pastor to talk of things that might be even remotely political or that might border on progressive social analysis. You know, for decades, mainline Protestant churches have been in decline in America. And for the last 30 years, our congregations, our regional governing bodies, and our denominations have responded to that decline by paying millions of dollars to buy books, to attend conferences, and to employ the services of church health and growth consultants, experts on growing churches. The net result has been that our numbers have continued to dwindle. But I don't have any better ideas about what should be done about our shrinking numbers. I trust that they know what they're talking about. But after reading a lot of what the church growth industry has produced, I can say with confidence that with one exception, no one thinks a shrinking congregation or denomination will be turned around by talking about politics or by engaging in social analysis from the pulpit. Besides, people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, they do politics, and we're not them, right? That's not our kind of people. It's not our kind of church. But every time I find myself tempted to agree with those who say churches should not engage in politics, and every time I start to edit the social analysis from my sermons, I remember the words of Martin Luther King in his letter from a Birmingham jail. Specifically, I remember this part where King writes, "I have traveled the length and breadth of Alabama, Mississippi, and all the other southern states. On sweltering summer days and crisp autumn mornings, I have looked at the South's beautiful churches with their lofty spires pointing heavenward. I have beheld the impressive outlines of her massive religious education buildings. Over and over, I have found myself asking, what kind of people worship here? And who is their God? Where were their voices when the lips of Governor Barnett dripped with words of interposition and nullification? Where were they when Governor Wallace gave a clarion call for defiance and hatred? Where were their voices of support when bruised and weary Negro men and women decided to rise from the dark dungeons of complacency to the bright hills of creative protest? I am haunted by those words. Especially when King asks, what kind of people worship here? And who is their God? When churches are silent about the inequality that remains in American society, when we're not talking about mass incarceration, when we're not joining our voices with those who challenge us to remember that Black Lives Matter, then I hear the echoes of King's challenge, particularly to white churches. What kind of people worship there? And who is their God? Now, I am grateful to be in a congregation where we are a people dedicated to social justice, a people who understand that God wants us to live into a world made new. What worries me is that so many of our sisters and brothers in other congregations don't share our commitments. American churches, particularly white American churches, need to change. We need to start caring more about issues like inequality and structural racism and white privilege. We need to change, and I believe American Christianity can change, especially if congregations like Montclair take a lead and stay strong. Part of why I believe American Christianity can change is that change is embedded in the DNA of our faith.
It is written in to our primary documents. Take, for example, the story told in this morning's lesson from the book of Acts. In the story, an Ethiopian eunuch is reading the book of Isaiah, and he ends up having a conversation with the apostle Philip after God's Spirit prompts the two men to meet each other on the road to Gaza. The end result of that conversation is that the eunuch got baptized and joined the early church. And it sounds like a really nice story about evangelism, which it is. But it also is, maybe primarily is, a story about change in the church. The book of Acts was written at a time when the church was undergoing its first major change. And that change was a transition from being a sect of Judaism to being a religion in its own right. And the story of the Ethiopian eunuch takes place in the context of that change. As Christianity was evolving into a separate religious tradition, there were those who wanted to exclude folks like the Ethiopian eunuch. They would have excluded him because he was a foreigner and because he had been emasculated. And those who championed a more exclusionary approach to faith seem to have been in control of the earliest church. But as those first Christians started meeting people, like this man from Ethiopia, the church began to change. It grew open, more inclusive, more international. And even though there are always those who resist it, churches have continued to change over the years. There have been big changes like the Protestant Reformation, but even in smaller ways, Christians have changed our minds over a host of issues. We evolve. We are informed by new ideas and by the history in which we live. Ours has never been a static faith. And usually it takes too long to change. But eventually, we do change. For example, the church has changed and has come to understand that slavery is not okay. We've changed. We've come to understand that laws separating communities, laws like apartheid and Jim Crow, they're not okay. In the United States, we changed so that we no longer believe monarchs have a divine right to their thrones. And among mainline Protestants, we've come to realize that women and men should have equal status in the church. And increasingly, we're understanding that gay men and lesbians should have equal status with their straight sisters and brothers as well. Change happens. And quite often, the change is good. And every time we change, we answer the question Martin Luther King asked in his letter from the Birmingham jail. What kind of people worship here? And who is their God? When we change to be more inclusive, we declare that we are an hospitable people who worship a welcoming God. When we talk about social justice and political realities, we declare that we are a people whose faith directs us to care about the common good, a people whose God longs to see the children of God living in a world made new. Now, with that in mind, I want to return to where I started the sermon by looking once more at how our media and how our society in general responded to two different demonstrations, both of which caused property damage. One in Ohio, where a predominantly white crowd went bonkers over a football game, something that, let's be honest, is essentially meaningless. And the other here in the East Bay, where a predominantly African-American group of protesters who were seeking to draw attention to a serious issue also engaged in demonstrations in which a few people damaged private property. The different responses to these events worries me. It worries me because I think it points to deep divisions in our society, divisions that I wish truly weren't there. I don't like living in a country where issues of race continue to rend the fabric that holds us together. I don't like living in a country where we are divided one from another. And to be totally honest, I don't know what ultimately can be done about it, except that I think I know where to start.
I think we need to start by paying attention. We need to pay attention. We need to be attentive to the ways our society treats people of various racial and economic backgrounds. And as we pay attention, those of us who are white can make note of our privilege so that we never are tempted to scorn those who have not enjoyed the advantages that we take for granted. It's easy to get discouraged and to think that after all this time, if we still haven't figured things out, we never will. But I know societal change can take a while. It's a long journey without much in the way of detailed maps, which means we must pay attention. We must listen. We must learn. We must follow those who are wise. For when we observe the world around us, we may yet discover how by our words and deeds and sacrifices and expressions of hope, we can join in the work that was Martin Luther King's work. And as we join in the work along with God's children from every race and religion and orientation and from every imaginable social and economic background, we will live into the fulfillment of a dream. And there will be no doubt who we are or who is our God. Amen.